This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Last month, President Biden signed legislation to declare Juneteenth a national holiday. Prior to that, Juneteenth had been recognized by several states across the country, but still remained unknown to many people. To learn more about the holiday and its celebrations, we're joined by James Webb, the owner and president of Indy Juneteenth. Welcome to the program, James. For those who are just now learning about Juneteenth, can you tell us what it is and why it's important?
Well, hello. Thanks for having me, by the way. But Juneteenth is the celebration of the emancipating of all people in the United States of America. It was the day on June 19th in 1865. It was the day when those specific slaves in Galveston, Texas, were informed by General Gordon Granger when he made an announcement in the headquarters of the Confederacy that all people have been emancipated and all slaves that were now free. So it was that day in 1865 that we've been celebrating ever since. Some states got it a little further, like in Kentucky, their date was August 8th. And slavery was on the books in Mississippi all the way until 2003. But technically, June 19th, 1865 is the day we celebrate.
Why is this important for folks to know about? What do you think people should know about it?
Well, because representation matters, and knowing the full story of a certain subject matters as well. I mean, we all enjoy it, like this last weekend, we all enjoyed celebrating the 4th of July. But the truth is that everyone wasn't independent on that day. There were people who looked like myself and my ancestors that were enslaved, and those people just weren't free. And it wasn't until 2.5 years later, on June 19th, 1865, that we were actually given the permission to be free, and that story needs to be heard.
Absolutely. And how has this holiday typically been celebrated before, you know, Biden announced this nationwide? How was it celebrated?
Okay, well, in the past, a way that our ancestors celebrated was that they baked, like, a lot of red velvet cakes. They weren't allowed to have sugar, so one thing that they used was the hibiscus flower, and they used that flower to celebrate and for, like, birthdays and weddings, and they made cakes. So they celebrated it by having red velvet cake. They had and that tradition has been passed down for over hundreds of years. Different families have different recipes. Some do cupcakes.
You know, usually celebrated through festivals and parties and barbecues. It's your typical your hamburger, hot dog kind of celebration.
Well, the red velvet cake is making me hungry now. Talking about that. So when it comes to the way it was celebrated over the years, and then now it's been federally recognized, does that take away any of the specialness of the holiday? Do you feel like it's being exploited now?
I think the potential to be exploited can come, but I think the beauty in it is that it's making it inclusive to everyone. It's allowing everyone to join in on the celebration, because one of the hardest things we've been doing for the past 5 years was just educating people on the holiday. But now that it's federal, not everyone knows about the day. Now we can diversify. We can include everyone in the celebration. I do think some people will get on the bandwagon. Some people will try to exploit it to the best of their abilities, but that was going to come anyway. And but now that it's federal, I think the beauty in it will tip the scale a lot more than the exploitation will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I noticed as soon as it was declared a holiday, I go to the store and suddenly there's a bunch of Juneteenth shirts. And I was just wondering, I mean, does that take away from the local community that maybe has already been making shirts like this?
Yes, it does. It does. Like, for my organization, for one, we've been making shirts like this for over 5 years, and we've been celebrating in certain ways for over 5 years. But a lot of people don't know how to get in touch with us, so they're more comfortable going to a Target or a Walmart and purchasing things like that. But it's also opened the doors for us to connect with the Walmarts and the Targets and the Amazons of the world and say, hey, we are a Juneteenth organization, and we do have merchandise and yard signs and flags and things like that for sale that we would love to market with you guys. So that as some doors close, some doors open.
Absolutely, yeah. And can you tell me about, is there a special Juneteenth flag? I feel like I might have seen folks waving different colors in their cars.
Well, Well, yeah, there's some confusion there, a little bit. The flag that people see is the Pan-African flag started by Marcus Garvey, the red, black, and green flag. That is actually not the Juneteenth flag. The Juneteenth flag was started by Ben Haith in, like, the late 80s or early 90s. He created it, and the Juneteenth colors, just like the American flag, are also red, white, and blue. There's a big star in the middle. And that represents the Lone Star State. It's because it started in Texas. And then there's multiple stars surrounding that Lone Star. It represents all of Americans. All of us are all joined together in that one star. And the colors blue represent the waters that we crossed over from the transatlantic slave trade and the rivers we crossed through on the Underground Railroad. And the red represents the blood our ancestors shed during slavery. And the white stands for unity.
Wow, that's very powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea what those stood for. And when it comes to sort of the federal government recognizing this year, do you know, was there anything that prompted this move? Did this feel like it came out of the blue?
To be honest, no. I feel for when we found out it was a little bit longer, but for 8 minutes and 46 seconds when we watched George Floyd be murdered by a police officer, I think Juneteenth was the day that was used to kind of weaponize, for lack of a better word, black unity. We used that day to come together as a community and celebrate something positive at the aftermath of watching that horrible transaction between those two adults. It was just something awful to watch, and I think Juneteenth was the medicine that was used to help us kind of get over what we actually saw. So once that happened, I think that lit the match and everything set on fire, went ablaze. Juneteenth kind of crazy a little bit. So because we were prepared for the holiday to, you know, kind of explode, we just weren't. We didn't expect it to grow so fast.
Right, right. And I wonder, you know, with the pandemic and everyone sort of having a moment of quiet and being home, if it made people more aware of Juneteenth and being able to pay attention.
Well, actually, 2020 was one of our best years. It allowed us to reach, 'cause we had a virtual celebration in 2020. And so, but we were able to reach people in New York City and celebrate with them virtually. We connected with Juneteenth organizations in California and Virginia and Buffalo, New York, and Milwaukee, and all over the country. And it kind of, we kind of like created this union, if you will, of Juneteenth organizations that have been doing this for 5, 10, 15 plus years. And I think that COVID, the COVID year allowed us to, I guess, do the groundwork of spreading the word. And in 2021, we actually were able to physically celebrate.
That's awesome. And when it comes to Juneteenth, I know, because we're talking about Juneteenth, I keep saying Juneteenth. But when it comes to this holiday and it being federally recognized, does this feel like it's enough for the black community? I mean, obviously, I'm going to say it's not, but what would the next thing be?
Well, it's not enough. And even as a Juneteenth, as an individual who owns a Juneteenth nonprofit organization, I would think they kind of skipped a few steps. Like, we would have much rather had an anti-lynching bill be passed than for Juneteenth to be a federal holiday. We would have much rather have had, you know, our school systems be funded differently than just property taxes in low-income communities. We would have loved to have more things, more grocery store food deserts. We would have loved to have more grocery stores in our black communities than to have Juneteenth be a federal holiday. So there's still more work to do. We would have loved to get to inform more black people on the importance of participating in the census. And how that affects our communities. We would have loved those things to have happened first, but we kind of take what you can and you keep running, you know, and you keep on fighting toward equality and you keep on fighting for diversity and inclusion. And Juneteenth was one of the things that fell from the tree, and we're glad that it's there because that deserved to happen as well.
Mm-hmm. And with Indie Juneteenth, you do this event every year, or are there any other events that you hold?
Well, we do events all throughout the year. Right now, we're getting ready for our back to school, Indy Juneteenth back to school parade. That'll be happening Labor Day weekend. We're having our first annual Indy Juneteenth Awards, where we'll be thanking educators and community organizers and people who do community service throughout the year. We do our food drives in November, and we do our clothing drives in December. We take our educational museum trips every year. We had to cancel due to COVID last year, but we were going to go to the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville, but we had to cancel that, so hopefully we can do that again. And this year, we were able to crown the first Miss Juneteenth in the state of Indiana, and that's a scholarship pageant where we were able to give away $2,500 scholarship to the winner and a $500 scholarship to the runner-up. Because one thing, unbeknownst to a lot of people, that Miss Juneteenth celebrations are huge with Juneteenth culture. So we were proud to be able to bring that to the state of Indiana for the first time.
Wow, you got a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. We're like we say, Juneteenth 365. We're a traditional nonprofit organization, and we do things year round.
That's awesome. And so for folks that are tuning in and want to know how to get involved or to participate, where should they go?
They can follow us on Facebook at Indy Juneteenth. They can follow us on Instagram at Indy Juneteenth, or they can go to our website, IndyJuneteenth.com, and just follow us. And we're always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for sponsors. We're always looking for charitable donations. And we're also looking to partner with other people. And we like to do community service as well. My wife and I started this nonprofit organization, yes, for Juneteenth, but also because we're both a service to our community and we're always willing to help out where we can.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing all of your insight and experience. It's been a pleasure to have you on. James Webb is the owner and president of Indy Juneteenth. After the break, we'll be joined by a researcher clinician to learn about the risk of having a second stroke and preventative practices. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Twitter or Facebook at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Did you know that one in four survivors of stroke will have a second one? We're going to find out why and learn more about stroke prevention education with Dr. Linda Williams, director of the stroke program at the Richard L. Rodebush VA Medical Center, research scientist at the Regan Streiff Institute and professor of neurology at Indiana University School of Medicine. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'd like to welcome Dr. Williams to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with what the signs are of stroke. I think we hear a lot about stroke, but we don't know exactly what we should be looking for.
Thanks for having me, Miriam. I think that's a great observation. Most patients still don't recognize stroke symptoms, and the biggest reason that we can't treat people acutely when they have a stroke is that they don't come into the hospital soon enough, usually because they don't recognize they're having a stroke. So the American Heart, American Stroke Association has promoted a really good acronym, which is FAST, F-A-S-T. Stroke symptoms come on very suddenly, and they tend to affect one side of the body. And FAST reminds people of what those symptoms are and that they should act quickly. So F stands for face. You can have sudden drooping or weakness of one side of the face. A stands for arm. You can have sudden weakness of one arm or one leg. So typically you can ask someone just to lift both of their arms up and see if one droops down. S is for speech. You can have sudden trouble speaking or trouble understanding other people speaking. And then T stands for time, which is a key component since stroke treatment has to be delivered very quickly after the onset of symptoms in order to be effective.
When it comes to stroke, I wonder, is this something that mostly affects older folks, or can anybody be at risk?
Risk does increase with age, but we're definitely seeing increases in stroke prevalence among somewhat younger groups of patients, so especially patients 50 and older. So really anyone in certainly middle age and older is at risk for stroke, and the risk does increase the older that someone gets.
And just for our listeners and for myself here, what exactly is a stroke, if you had to characterize it, when someone says that they've had a stroke, what is happening to their body?
Sure. That's a great question, because it's not quite as simple as you might think. There are actually two broad types of stroke. The very common type that represents about 85% of all strokes is when there's a blockage of a blood vessel in the brain, or a blood vessel leading to the brain. And so typically when someone says stroke, that's the kind that they're talking about. I like to say, if you think about plumbing, it's like your pipe is blocked. There's no blood getting down past that blockage. And so any brain tissue that normally relies on that blood supply for oxygen and glucose begins to die. And the brain tissue dies very quickly when that happens. So that's the vast majority of strokes. The other types of strokes are called ischemic stroke. Hemorrhagic stroke is the other 10 to 15% of strokes. That's like a pipe bursting. So a blood vessel bursts and blood leaks into the brain. And those types of strokes can have similar symptoms, but the hemorrhagic strokes specifically also tend to present with a sudden severe headache, worst headache of your life, all of a sudden. That would be a worrisome sign for the bleeding type of stroke. So that's really what's happening when someone has a stroke. The brain is in most cases losing blood supply to a portion of the brain. And it's really urgent. It's estimated that every second that someone's having a stroke, 32,000 brain cells are dying. So it's very important to get in quickly to the hospital, call 911. Don't wait for your friend or your family member to come home and take you to the hospital. Call 911, get there as quickly as you can so that treatment can be offered.
Mm-hmm. And when you said 32,000 brain cells are dying, I mean, that sounds very scary. Does that mean if you have a stroke and rush to the hospital, you are not going to come out the same person?
You may not. The brain has a great ability. We like to say it's plastic. So it has a great ability to heal and sort of make new networks after a stroke happens. But typically when someone has a stroke, there is at least some portion of the brain and the brain cells in the area that was most affected by the loss of blood supply that do not come back. What happens in recovery is that the brain cells around that area, as you do therapy and try to work to regain function, those brain cells sort of sprout new connections and make new networks to get around the area of damage. And that's how we try to direct our therapy, to make that network development as effective as possible so you can regain function.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the research that you've been doing in this area, what focus have you been working on?
Well, some of the work that I've been doing recently is with the VA's telestroke program. So that's a system where, via telehealth connection, a stroke specialist can provide emergency care for a veteran that's in an emergency room, perhaps in a rural area that doesn't have a stroke specialist. And so that's one of the large projects we've been working on. The VA has a large system now that serves over 50, mainly small and rural hospitals, so that veterans can receive high quality acute stroke care. So that's been one of the major areas. Another area that I've worked in is on the recovery side, which has to do with the detection and treatment of depression after stroke.
And I know we were talking about the likelihood that if you've had a stroke, you're likely to get it again. What causes that? Is it lifestyle, or is it just that's how it is?
It's probably a little bit, you know, all of the above. So you are more likely to have a stroke if you've had one already. I think, as you mentioned in the intro, about 25% of people that have had a stroke will have another one. The risk is highest in that first year after you've had your first stroke. And it probably does relate somewhat to lifestyle, things that we've done or not done over the years that might be hard to reverse in our body. It might also be related to risk factors that you have, like high blood pressure, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, things like that. And there's probably also some small genetic component to stroke risk, although we don't understand that very well. And so far, there's not really a large definitive single gene that seems to be related to stroke risk.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was going to ask you if it's lifestyle or genetics, you know, if you knew that you had the genes, if you could prevent it.
I think there's probably work that we're doing there that will help us learn, especially around things like how your body handles cholesterol. And so if you knew as a young person that, that your body tended to handle cholesterol in a way that made you likely to develop blocked arteries, perhaps that would make us in our younger years develop better habits around diet and exercise. Or it might identify people who would benefit from specific treatments early, even before they had had a stroke or a heart attack or something like that. And I do think that's probably where our precision medicine hopefully will be taking us in the not too distant future.
Well, what should people do to increase their knowledge about stroke prevention and education? Is there anything that our listeners could do that would help them sort of from a preventative level?
Sure. I think where prevention is concerned, one resource is the American Stroke Association, which is just www.stroke.org. That's an affiliated branch of the American Heart Association. They have excellent patient pages for patients, for caregivers, some of them dealing with recovering after stroke, but some of them also dealing specifically with prevention. So I think there are a number of good resources there that are very consumable by the average person that can help you identify simple things like exercising, like dietary changes that might be beneficial. The new stroke guidelines that were just published last month, some of the new things that guideline document did is provide some real focus on things like lifestyle change, like behavior change, education, physical activity recommendations, dietary recommendations that would be very appropriate for patients to learn about. I think another thing that patients can do is if you know you have a risk factor for stroke, like high blood pressure, it's very important to be your own best advocate, to measure your blood pressure consistently at home, keep a record of it, provide that information to your healthcare team so that they can help you manage your blood pressure appropriately. It's more than just taking a medicine and then maybe checking in with the doctor 6 months later. You really want to know if your blood pressure is controlled on a day-to-day basis. Blood pressure is the largest risk factor for stroke. It accounts for the most strokes in the United States if we look just at specific risk factors, because it's such a common risk factor and it increases the risk for both the ischemic type of stroke and the hemorrhagic type of stroke.
So over the years, have you noticed a change in the way stroke care is? Is it more accessible? Is it more likely that patients will recover fully? Have things changed sort of in the medical front?
There have been some interesting changes. One of the exciting changes has been the development of some additional treatments. The main medical treatment for stroke is a medication that's given intravenously, and it has to be given within 4.5 hours of when the symptoms start. So when that treatment was first developed over 20 years ago, most patients didn't come in time. I do think that that public education campaigns have been helpful. Systems of care around ambulances, delivering patients to the right hospitals that are able to provide treatment. Those kinds of things have all worked together to increase the likelihood that someone will present early enough and will have access to that treatment. So that's very exciting. And more recently, a second type of therapy has been shown to be effective. It's for a very specific type of patient. This is a patient who has a blood clot in a large blood vessel that is retrievable. So someone can go in with a catheter and actually pull that blood clot out of the artery. So this is very highly specialized therapy, only can be done at a few large medical centers. There are two or three in Indianapolis that can do that. And so for those patients, we have to develop systems of care where ambulances can deliver patients to those hospitals specifically that are able to provide that very high level of what's called endovascular or clot retrieval therapy for patients. Mm-hmm. But both of those things are effective for patients. They significantly increase the chance that someone will be independent after a stroke. And they're both very time sensitive. So again, we always emphasize for our patients at risk and for our patients who've had a stroke that not delaying is really the key to ensuring you have the best chance to access therapy.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the risk factors for folks that smoke or take birth control? I feel like I've heard those up your risks of a stroke.
That is true for women. So, and especially for young women who typically don't have a very elevated risk for stroke, the combination of smoking and especially some of the older classes of birth control pills, that was associated and continues to be associated with a higher risk of stroke and other blood clots forming. So for younger women, most of the newer birth control pills don't have as serious an effect, but smoking, of course, still does. And so smoking remains, especially in Indiana, one of the risk factors that many of our patients have and struggle to try to manage and deal with as a way to reduce their risk of stroke. Sometimes someone who's had a stroke, especially if it's a relatively minor stroke, it's a little bit of a wake-up call, kind of a teachable moment. And so I do have a number of patients who aren't allowed to smoke in the hospital when they've had their stroke, and that sort of jump starts them to smoking cessation activities afterwards. So it's always encouraging when that happens, because smoking is one thing that if you can stop smoking, your risk of stroke does go back down within a couple of years to the risk that you would have had if you never smoked. So that seems to be somewhat of a reversible risk for patients who are able to stop smoking.
Mm. Well, has the pandemic complicated anything for stroke patients or those at risk?
I think it has, just like it has for all of us, probably. The acute care, so emergency care for stroke, hasn't been complicated too much by COVID. The telehealth, like I mentioned, the VA system and other systems of telehealth for acute stroke care, those have been around for 10 or more years and are very well established and, of course, don't require you to be in the same physical location as the patient. So those have kind of gone on as we would expect. I think that both for patients recovering from stroke who might like to get back in to see their neurologist and especially to see their physical therapist or speech therapist in person, I think that COVID has complicated that to some extent. Although we're getting better about delivering therapies virtually as well, the VA has a large program of virtual physical and speech therapy that seems to work pretty well for patients. And I do think for patients, unfortunately, just difficulty in accessing their primary care for some patients has led to lapses in their blood pressure medication or their cholesterol medication. And so that unfortunately has, I think, increased the risk and caused some people to have strokes just because they weren't able to keep consistent with their medication use.
Yeah. I think it's been tough, you know, just going for regular checkups and stuff and trying to weigh the benefits and the risks of going out during COVID. But when it comes to stroke, was there anything that you saw worsening due to the pandemic? Like, I wonder if COVID-19 itself increases any risks.
You know, it's interesting. COVID-19 does increase the risk of stroke and of other blood clot formation. However, there's been a very interesting phenomena for both stroke and heart attack that the rates of stroke and heart attack in the first few months of the pandemic, sort of the early phases of lockdown, really dropped precipitously. And this was seen across all kinds of healthcare systems. The VA saw it, university healthcare systems. There's a large national registry called Get With The Guidelines Stroke that the American Stroke Association keeps with over 1,000 hospitals. Everybody saw this drop in stroke cases and MI cases coming in. And so we're not really sure why that happened. It doesn't seem like they were just staying at home, like the mild patients were just staying at home, because the patients we were seeing didn't have more severe stroke. And so I think some of our researchers are trying to figure out, was it something about better air quality or less stress driving to work and commuting, or what happened in those first few months that actually caused those rates to drop? They seem to have then over the summer kind of climbed back to the usual rates. And so we're not seeing any more of that currently, but it's been sort of an interesting dual phenomenon with COVID.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And I'm going to hedge a guess here and say it's probably less stress. You know, working from home is a blessing.
I think for many of us, it has been, although I've often said I'm glad I don't have small children at home right now, because I think that would be the hardest job of all.
Yes, it's definitely tough when you have to be the teacher and the parent and working. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Dr. Linda Williams, Director of the Stroke Program at the Richard L. Rodebush VA Medical Center, Research Scientist at the Regenstrief Institute, and Professor of Neurology at Indiana University School of Medicine. Up next, we'll look into the COVID-19 Delta variant. Is it spreading in Indiana? If you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us a voice message without making a call by using our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. The Delta variant has spread throughout the country when it comes to COVID-19, and reports of Delta variant cases are growing and appear to be in areas where vaccination rates are low. To learn more about this variant, we're joined by Shandy Durth, Director of the Center for Public Health Practice at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Shandy, it's always good to have you here with us. Let's talk about this variant. Where is it coming from?
Hi, Miriam. It's great to be back, although I will be happy to talk about something other than COVID one day. So basically what we're seeing with Delta, it's another, basically any variant is a mutation of a virus, and that's very common for this to happen with any kind of virus. For example, flu virus will mutate a little bit each year, and that's why we have a different flu vaccine each year. But what we're seeing with the Delta, which is of concern, is the fact that it's so contagious. And so it is moving across the U.S. at this point. We have had confirmed cases here in Indiana. You can actually keep an ongoing tally of what the state finds among their own lab testing on their state dashboard. They do a great job of updating that on a regular basis. But right now what we're hearing from CDC is Delta is spreading so quickly that we expect in another 3 to 4 weeks, it will be the dominant strain of COVID that we see here in the U.S.
And what makes this different from the other types of COVID, aside from it being highly contagious, is it any more dangerous?
So right now, we're not seeing necessarily an increased rate of hospitalization or deaths with this necessarily, but it is more contagious. And the problem with that is we could eventually start to see more hospitalizations and more deaths just because it could start affecting more of those vulnerable people, people with other health conditions that are more likely to end up in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember reading first that it was spreading really bad in England, and now it seems that it's made its way to the U.S. But I think we have better vaccination rates probably than most countries, or am I wrong?
Some countries have actually done better than us. We actually have a lot of vaccine available here. They might not have in other countries, but unfortunately, we are not taking that advantage of that gift that we have. So we definitely need to increase our vaccination. I believe President Biden has called July the month of action for vaccination. So we're definitely trying to get more creative in how to get people to show up, take the vaccine, and how to reach those populations.
Right. Well, at the top of the show, when there was the news report, they mentioned that I think in Israel, they were studying Pfizer and saying that it may not be as effective against the Delta variant. Does that hinder efforts to get people vaccinated when they hear these things like, well, it's not really going to work?
I can see that side of it. I can see why some people might just use that as another reason to hesitate and think, oh, I'm just going to wait for another vaccine. But there's not another vaccine coming right now. And still 60-something percent, which is what Israel is reporting instead of the regular 80%, 90% effectiveness, is still really good. If you think about the annual flu vaccinations that we give every year pre-COVID, that's typically a lot of times in the 40, 50% range. And that's still really effective in making a huge dent on hospitalizations and deaths. And what we've seen so far here in the U.S. is the vaccines that we have are still very effective against Delta. So we're actually still seeing higher rates than that 60% that came out of Israel. And so if I had my choice between no vaccine and a vaccine that was 60-something percent effective, I would still take that. A vaccine that's 60-something percent effective is still really effective and very useful. And again, those people who had the vaccine but still get the Delta variant, they're a lot less likely to be hospitalized or to die from COVID. And so it's still worth it to go ahead and get the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between the Delta and the Delta Plus?
I'm not as familiar with the Delta Plus. There's probably a slight change on the Delta Plus. Typically, if they haven't completely switched names, they've just seen another mutation on that, but not enough that it varies that differently.
Mm-hmm. Now, when it came to this Delta spreading in other countries where they didn't have enough vaccine, I mean, it really took a toll. And I mean, then there were even things like this fungus that was spreading. Is that something we need to worry about here?
It is, because we still have large pockets, especially in rural areas around the U.S., where we've got some really low vaccination rates. If you just look at the Indiana vaccination map that the State Department of Health has on their website, we've got several counties that are still in the low 30% range for vaccination. So we're not anywhere close to that herd immunity in most of Indiana. In more of the urban areas, we're hitting closer to the 40s, high 40s, 50%, sometimes even closer to 60%. But we are way below where we need to be, and we're one of the lowest vaccination rates among the other Midwest states.
Oh, wow. So we need to get those vaccines going.
Yes.
Well, when it comes to this particular variant, I know it's still up in the air, and I know a lot of things are, you know, they have to look at studies and test things out. But do you think this could cause restrictions to be brought back in place if it gets out of control?
It's definitely possible, at least at a local level. I mean, if you think about what you saw a couple of months ago in LA, where that variant caused a big surge in cases because they didn't have a lot of people vaccinated yet, it hit their emergency departments pretty hard. They were having some surge capacity issues. And so it's not out of question that it couldn't happen in other parts around the country here with Delta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was just reading about LA County. Some places are asking folks to wear masks indoors, even if they're vaccinated, because of this Delta variant. Do you think we will see that happen in Indiana?
It's possible, again, especially at the local level, where the local health officials could work with their city county councils, their county commissioners, to say, look, it's at the point where we need to look at having some more mask use indoors again. And again, it's still recommended by CDC, if you go indoors and you're not vaccinated, to wear a mask. But again, with Delta, with it being so contagious, it's not going to hurt anyone to wear a mask. And so I myself, if I find myself in a very crowded indoor situation, even though I'm vaccinated, I still have my mask with me. Mm-hmm. So I encourage others to consider doing that as well.
Yeah, I've just gotten so used to wearing the mask. I kind of like the anonymity. I'm like, I'm just going to wear it all the time.
Exactly right. You can yawn. You don't have to like cover your mouth. You can, you know, not use that as your excuse to not wear makeup. So there are lots of pluses, I think, to a mask use.
Right. I can avoid people I don't want to talk to. They don't know who I am.
Right. Exactly. Hide a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to this specific variant with Delta, and it's becoming more contagious, does that mean this can continue to grow and change and become bigger and bigger? Or is there like an end point when it's just like it won't morph anymore?
Now, unfortunately, a virus can keep morphing. And so that's another reason to go ahead and squash this while we've got the chance. Right now, we've got vaccines that will work against Delta, but we need to go ahead and vaccinate. I was thinking of last night how to explain this to people who don't live in public health all the time. And, you know, we're in Indiana, it's summertime, it's that time of year where if the weeds start to get your vegetable garden or your flower garden, and if you don't get those weeds right now, by next week, you're going to pay the price, you're going to really kick yourself. And I think we're kind of in that sweet spot right now with COVID. Now is the time to really go ahead and hit that higher number of vaccinations. Otherwise, we could pay the price later on here in another month or two. And you've got to think, schools are going to start again. Colleges will start to go back. We're going to have more people together again in these congregate settings. We need to do a better job of protecting our population.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if this gets bigger than it is right now, if people are going to have to go back into a lockdown or not go back in person, if it will get to that point.
I think that there would be such a pushback at this point, and we've seen other, you know, consequences of the lockdown, things like that, mental health challenges that we faced, mm-hmm. economic challenges, that I think that would really be on a very small, localized level. So maybe we're looking at things such as some school districts might have to plan to be virtual for a short amount of time until numbers go down. You know, some employers might push some of their employees to be virtual again. And at the same time, I'm still hearing of lots of employers who are still letting their people work from home. And so we're not really back to normal 100%, But if we were to flip that switch, I think we could definitely see those numbers increase. Again, we've got vaccine out there. We can get back to normal, but we've got to take advantage of the vaccine that we have. We can't help ourselves if we don't get vaccinated.
If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Now, when it comes to vaccines, I think a lot of folks who are, you know, getting vaccines are waiting for the kids to get the vaccine. So, I mean, I'm just thinking about myself. I want my kids to get the vaccine. But with this Delta variant floating around, it feels kind of scary. Like, well, do we just keep the kids at home?
Right. And what I would say is I would remind everyone, kids 12 and up can get vaccinated. The vaccines are safe for those kiddos too. Go ahead and get your kids vaccinated now. You want them fully vaccinated before they go back to the classroom would be my recommendation. If any parents are out there hesitating to get vaccinated, go ahead and get vaccinated now. See that you're going to get through the vaccine and be fine. And then take your kiddos and to get vaccinated. And as far as staying home, you know, that's not an easy yes or no answer, because again, what we've seen is educational attainment has suffered for some kids, some more than others. Mm-hmm. So that's of concern. It's not a simple solution to just shut down schools, because a lot of kids rely on schools for regular meals and things like that. Right. And so, I mean, those of us in privilege who have the ability to stay home and we're still able to get food and education and use Zoom, that's kind of easy for us, but it's not that easy for everyone. So again, right, that's why we need to help each other get through all of this and make sure that we're enabling others to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Are we seeing the spread though more among, when we say unvaccinated, is it more children that are spreading it, or is it just anyone who's not vaccinated?
A lot of the cases that we're seeing right now are among people in their late teens, 20s, 30s, kind of that group that all along during COVID, you know, they've kind of understood that they're less likely to die from it. And also they haven't quite maintained as much social distancing as some of the older people who are aware of their own personal health consequences of getting COVID. And so that's the message we really have to get out there is, yes, you might get COVID and you might be fine, but think about the fact that you're helping spread it to other people who might not be okay. And again, that's where we've really got to work on going out to where these crowds of people are in their 20s and 30s. We need to go to employers. We need to go to the colleges and universities and really push the vaccinations there.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think a vaccine mandate would help in these types of situations, like at businesses and institutions, to somehow have some way to mandate that people get this done if they can, versus just leaving it up to someone to just decide?
Yes, we've seen that mandates are effective. And actually, Kaiser Health just released kind of a vaccine update last week. They've been doing a regular report since the vaccinations came out about the public perception of vaccine and why people get vaccinated and why people don't get vaccinated. And what they're finding is that more than half of the people in the survey answered that they agreed that employers should require workers to be vaccinated. And more than 60% of people said that they thought colleges and universities should require vaccine. So a lot of people agree with the stance that vaccines are a good thing, but we've got to make the vaccines accessible, and we need to make sure that employers are also offering that time off to go get the vaccine. We see a huge jump in vaccination rates when employers enable people. So they give them time off to go get vaccine. They give them time off in case they have any of the side effects from the vaccine, especially around the second dose. Employers who do that have much higher vaccination rates among their staff. And again, it's really to the employer's benefit. Your employers or your employees will stay healthy and safe and continue to go to work, and you're not going to have a big outbreak at your workplace setting.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the World Health Organization versus the CDC, I've noticed there's often mixed messaging where the WHO will come out and be like, this is a variant of concern, we need to do things, put masks or something like that. And then the CDC is like, everything is fine, keep doing what you're doing. Why is there this discrepancy?
Yes, and that can be confusing and frustrating for all of us. But when you think about the World Health Organization, you have to think about the fact that the World Health Organization is over the entire world. So they're giving advice to third world countries that have very little resources. They're giving advice to the U.S. that has lots of resources. Whether or not we use them is another question. And so a lot of times their guidance might be more protective, more conservative in what they give out, whereas CDC is still pretty adamant that if you're vaccinated, you don't have to mask. And again, I think that's because they're trying to use not wearing a mask as kind of the carrot to get people to vaccinate. Again, it doesn't hurt you to wear a mask. They're not saying don't wear a mask. They're just saying it's okay if you don't go wear a mask. Mm-hmm. But again, science is always changing around this. Viruses change. We don't have control over this. So it's not impossible that CDC might not come out in a month or two and say, look, Delta has spread enough. We're seeing enough cases that we think everyone should go back to wearing a mask. They might change their guidance. None of this is set in stone. It's still fairly a new virus for us.
Right. I think that's the hardest part is for folks, you know, when there's this unknown thing happening and then you're told one thing, then you're told another, it can get so frustrating that you just don't even know who to believe anymore.
Right. And I agree. But I just remind everyone, this is, you know, human biology. It's a virus that we've not dealt with before on this level. And so things are changing. Again, like I said, viruses mutate on a regular basis. We see it every year with flu. Mm-hmm. And we just have to deal with that with COVID as well. I mean, we wish we had all the answers. None of us enjoy working on COVID. We all want to go back to other public health activities. But unfortunately, we can't ignore it. We have to deal with it right now still.
Right. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, I know you mentioned it's kind of like the flu. People get shots every year for the flu. How would you approach saying to folks who say, well, if it is like the flu, then I'm just going to wait?
Well, what I would warn people about COVID is that it actually is much worse than the flu. We have much higher fatality rates than what we've seen with seasonal flu. We have much higher hospitalization rates. We have a lot of issues with people being long haulers. So people who had COVID last year are still having symptoms. And we don't see that really with influenza. So it's not the same as flu. I would really encourage everyone to highly consider getting your COVID vaccine, if not already. And let your friends and family know that you got your vaccine because they're going to listen to you. They're going to see that you got your vaccine and that you're safe and everything is fine. And then you might help encourage that person to get vaccinated as well.
Mm-hmm. And one last question. Do you think that children under the age of 12 are going to see any signs toward progress for a vaccine?
Yes, we're hoping this fall to have vaccines approved for kids under 12. So I'm very hopeful as a parent. I have an 11-year-old who just turned 11, so he's nowhere close enough to having the vaccine yet before school starts. That makes me apprehensive. I'm going to go ahead and have my kiddo wear a mask in the school setting, even though the school has already said masks won't be required. But I think as a parent, that's one of those steps I can do to help protect my kiddo. Because again, we don't know the long-term consequences of COVID either. Just because the kid looks fine today with COVID doesn't mean in 10 years there aren't going to be issues that we eventually find out were traced back to COVID. We just don't know. It's too new of a virus.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Shandy Durth, Director of the Center for Public Health Practice at Indiana University's Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation about an Indiana nonprofit raising awareness of abuse and exploitation of adults with disabilities. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.